When you run a private practice, you're not just a therapist, you're a business owner, a compliance officer, a marketing team, and most of all, a human being. The team at Alma gets that at a very real level. They make it easy to take insurance with support and with tools that keep your private practice running smoothly so that you can practice and focus on what matters the most, which is serving our clients well. They have an all-in-one EHR, a peer community, as well as free CEUs, meaning that you're not navigating the private practice journey on your own. You can learn more about Alma and the awesome services that they provide over at sellingthecouch.com/Alma. Alma is spelled A-L-M-A, and if you go through that link, you get 2 months absolutely free. sellingthecouch.com/Alma. Hey, it's Melvin. If you're a therapist who's been wanting and feeling a quiet pull toward either podcasting, YouTube, online courses, writing, or speaking, I wanted to gently invite you into our new community called Haven. Haven is for therapists who want to build online income in a way that feels calm, supported, and sustainable. You'll be placed into a small pod of 5 to 7 other therapists who are at a similar stage, so you're never doing this alone. And each quarter, we host live hands-on accelerators where the focus isn't on more noise, it's simply on helping you get meaningful work done. Our first accelerator begins on January 13th, 2026, and it's focused on AI-proofing your existing or future online course. You'll also have weekly work sessions, monthly coaching calls, and steady support from our team, all in a very real life-friendly rhythm. Haven is $497 per quarter or $1,497 for the year. You can learn more at sellingthecouch.com/Haven. Hello, hello. Welcome to today's session of Selling the Couch. I hope you're doing well, having an awesome day. So today's podcast is titled Flex Your Feelings, How to Build Emotional Fitness as a Therapist and as a Quiet Leader. I'm joined by my friend, Dr. Emily Anhalt. Emily's website is over at dremilyanhalt.com. Emily released a book recently called Flex Your Feelings. Emily and I actually connected a number of years ago when we were both active on Twitter. This is like the early stages of the pandemic. And we've been able to reconnect more recently, connecting on LinkedIn, loving just many of the things that she's sharing. I also think it's incredibly cool to see another psychologist doing such different things. And expanding what we can do with our careers. Today, I wanted to have Emily on because I know that many of us talk about things like self-care. Many of us are concerned about burnout. Many of us are really trying to reconcile like building these businesses and being in sort of a capitalist sort of system, but also realizing we, you know, as clinicians, like our wise selves know, you know, there's a cost to growth and how do we think about that and all of these things. And that's why I had Emily on. And so we talk a lot about this concept of emotional fitness and what that actually means and how it's different from emotional intelligence. We then dive into some of the traits of emotional fitness, actually the 7 traits that are there, and including the one that's actually the most relevant or the one that therapists particularly struggle with the most. And then we dive into this area of how do we start training our emotional muscles if we've never learned how? This is, I think, relevant for many of us because we enter these, we enter our field with a genuine desire to help, but many of us also have sort of people-pleasing tendencies. And so how does that sort of intersect and how do we shift things? I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. So here's my conversation with Dr. Emily Anhalt from dremilyanhalt.com. Emily, welcome to Selling the Couch.
It's so great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
It's This is like way too long. I feel like we were Twitter friends and then became LinkedIn friends, but it's so good to finally like connect in person. I'm just so proud of you. You're doing such amazing stuff. I mean, who would have guessed, you know, us as psychologists would be doing such interesting and varied things.
Thank you. The feeling is so mutual, and it's so wonderful to get to collaborate with other professionals like yourself.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm excited for our conversation. You just released a book, Flex Your Feelings, doing some pretty amazing stuff. We can't wait to hear about that. And I had a bunch of questions for you, and maybe we'll start here. What does emotional fitness actually mean, and how is it different than emotional intelligence?
So emotional fitness is an ongoing practice of strengthening your mental and emotional health. And I coined this term a number of years ago because I work with a lot of high-functioning people who don't necessarily resonate with this kind of dichotomy we have where you're either mentally healthy or mentally ill. I think a lot of people live somewhere in between, and everyone could level up their mental health in some way. And so I wanted to figure out how to talk about it in a more proactive way to help people think about working on their mental health more like going to the gym and less like going to the doctor. So if you think about emotional intelligence as being more about awareness, knowing your emotions and other people's emotions, emotional fitness is about application. Just the way physical fitness helps you become more physically fit and physically strong and physically capable, emotional fitness helps you become more emotionally intelligent and more emotionally capable. So by building things like resilience and communication and empathy and the other traits through consistent practice, you will have a healthier and stronger emotional life overall.
Mm. I love the application of it. Like that's such a wonderful, like, I feel like it's just a wonderful like perspective and a more holistic look at it. And I love the fact that you said it's like ongoing. You outlined 7 traits of emotional fitness. Which one do you find therapists and founders struggle with the most?
Mm. So the first of the traits is first for a reason, and it's because it's so foundational and you have to work on that first one to do any of the others. And that first one is mindfulness, which I define as becoming more comfortable being uncomfortable. So just throwing kind of a broad net, everyone out there could do some work around this. We all have areas of discomfort that we tend to avoid. And I think therapists tend to have different areas of discomfort. Therapists are comfortable with a lot of things that an average person might not be comfortable with. But it doesn't mean that we don't have our unique areas of discomfort. And so it's really important that we think about what those are and work on them. Like I can just share personally, I think because I was never really great at feeling and facing my own anger, I was not as good at empathizing with and holding space for my patient's anger, because until you can be comfortable with an emotion yourself, you're not going to encourage it in other people. So I really had to work on that in myself so that I could show up better for my patients. So mindfulness comes to mind in that way. But I would say if I had to pick one that I think all therapists should work on more, it's playfulness. Being a yes and person and being able to exist in the gray. And even though I think therapists intellectually understand the importance of that, we tend to take our work really seriously and we deal with really serious stuff. And sometimes I think we forget that really therapy is just teaching people how to play. And I remember when I was learning to become a therapist, I had a wonderful supervisor who helped me understand that even though theory and doing things the right way is important to think about, ultimately, being flexible and open and meeting your patients where they are is the true work to be done. I had a patient who was a musician, and I told my supervisor, I wish that I could play him songs that make me think of what I think he's feeling. And my supervisor said, well, why can't you? Who's saying you can't do that? And it occurred to me, oh, I had this sort of theoretical superego that was keeping me from being playful. And once I started doing that, the work really opened up. So I would say we could all be a little more playful.
That's such a great example, because I think, right, we understand this intellectually. We go through grad school, we read books on all of this, but then I feel like the real beauty of therapy is in that creativity that comes out of it, right? And I mean, you remember that many years later, right? Like, which is so cool. Why is emotional fitness especially important for people like in helping roles or in leadership?
So I'd say that leaders and helpers and therapists for sure are sort of emotional first responders in a way. We absorb stress and conflict and uncertainty from the people that we're supporting. And we've all heard the idea of put your own oxygen mask on first. But when you're a person who ties their identity to being a helper, that often goes out the window, and we will often sacrifice ourselves to support other people. And the problem is that that's just not sustainable. If we don't have strong emotional muscles ourselves, we're going to get depleted really quickly. And emotional fitness ensures that we can show up for other people without losing ourselves, that we can make sure that we are not pouring from an empty cup and that we can do this work over the long term. So emotional fitness helps you build boundaries. It helps you communicate what you need. It helps make sure that you're not offering more than you actually have to give. And when you're in a helper position, that's such an important, really business asset, but also just personal, a positive trait to have.
Yeah. No, I think especially that conversation around like what you shared about boundaries, I feel like this is something I've had to like learn, like unlearn and then relearn, because I think there is, in sometimes in subtle ways, sometimes not, there's a understanding or there's this weird messaging around therapists have to be like self-sacrificing.
Right.
Right. And especially I think when therapists go into private practice or create some sort of business, that mindset plays out because it's like I have to give it, you know, beyond what I can like reasonably do because I am like a helping person, or it plays out with undercharging or any of these different things.
Gosh, it's so true. And a few things come to mind. First of all, I feel like we have this sort of puritanical, you know, Judeo-Christian society of sacrifice equals love, and that if you are not suffering a little bit, you're not really caring for people. Mm-hmm. And intellectually, I think we know that's not true, but we often do act that way. And then you're so right about this idea of undercharging, and we feel bad making any money. And we know that really therapy is all about boundaries. You know, we start on time, we end on time, we meet in the same place every week, we don't date or become friends with our patients outside of session. And these boundaries are what make that deep empathy within that hour every week possible. And I think it's important to remember that that also applies to making sure that we have personal boundaries so that we don't get resentful, and that we have financial boundaries so that our work is sustainable over time. I really want to encourage people to advocate for themselves in that way, and to know that you're actually serving your clients best when you are taking care of yourself in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's that proverbial, like put the mask on right before. Yeah. You help others. I think, I don't know, this is taking me way too long to realize this, but like the proportion of the ways that I care for myself and I engage in play and in relationships has such a direct impact on my business success. Totally. Whereas I used to see it the other way around, right? Like business success would allow me to do those things. It sounds like, you just said totally. So like, it sounds like it's also been true for you.
For sure. It feels like it's part of the journey. I think grad school should have a class about this specifically, because it's really complicated to find a compromise between capitalism and this sort of deep, nurturing, altruistic soul that I think most of us have to go into this work. And, you know, ultimately, I think I have taught my patients a lot about having their own boundaries by upholding mine with them. And then when they have feelings about those boundaries, being able to talk about them and saying, yeah, like, you know, you can care about someone and still prioritize your own care alongside theirs. And isn't that an interesting thing? So for sure, I think we all have some unlearning and relearning to do around this.
When I first started selling the couch, I remember a few colleagues quietly wondering why I didn't just stay with clinical work. And what I wish I had back then was a calm and supportive place for therapists who felt that same quiet pull toward something more. That's why we created Haven, our new community for therapists exploring online income through podcasting, YouTube, online courses, writing, and speaking. Inside Haven, you'll be placed into a small pod of 5 to 7 therapists who are at a similar stage. So there's real connection and gentle accountability. And in between all of that, we run hands-on accelerators every quarter, not to overwhelm you, but to help you actually make steady progress on this online income journey. Our first accelerator starts on January 13, 2026, and it's focused on AI-proofing your online course, whether you already have one or you're just beginning to imagine it. Between these accelerators, you'll have weekly work sessions, monthly coaching calls, and a kind ongoing support from our team, all designed to protect your time and, most importantly, your nervous system. And something that matters deeply to me, 10% of every paid membership supports a scholarship fund for girls that have been rescued from the commercial sex trade. As a dad now raising a daughter, this work especially feels close to my heart. Haven is reasonably priced at $497 per quarter. That includes accelerators, multiple coaching calls, and also the multiple weekly hours, as well as a pod. Or it's $1,497 for the year. You can learn more at sellingthecouch.com/Haven, and I would love to have you join us. Speaking of which, like, how do you even start to train these emotional muscles? Like, even like if you've never learned how?
So in the book, I talk about this idea of emotional push-ups, these small emotional exertions that put you just a little outside of your comfort zone so you can grow stronger. If you think about physical push-ups, it's the same. You know, you can't only do one physical push-up. You have to do them often, and you do more over time. And then not only do you get stronger now, but your body becomes healthier and you're less likely to get sick down the line. And the same is true with emotional push-ups. If you push yourself just a little outside of your emotional comfort zone every day, then over time, that comfort zone grows larger, and you also are going to prevent a lot of the emotional struggles that we face, like burnout, stress, anxiety, depression, all of that, because we're creating space for us to become stronger in that way. So what emotional push-up looks like for me might be different than it looks for you, because it's ultimately about what makes each of us just a little uncomfortable. So for some people, an emotional push-up might be saying no when you don't have capacity for something, even though you kind of want to say yes because you're a people pleaser. Or an emotional push-up might be putting your phone away at 8 p.m. and just being present with your thoughts at night instead of scrolling. Or an emotional push-up might be apologizing for a mistake, even though you feel kind of uncomfortable having the conversation. So where do you start? Essentially, make a list of what are the things that tend to make you a little more uncomfortable than they make other people, and how can you take one small step toward that discomfort instead of away from it today?
Mm. So much of this is these little steps, right? And I think, especially as clinicians, like, at least I'll speak for myself, I always think like I have to do these grand gestures, right? But it really is, like you said, like it starts with these little push-ups. Yeah. And it's the compounding effects of those that versus like waiting for one, you know, to do one thing like in one day.
Exactly. And, you know, we know that small steps make big change, but it can be hard to get started sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you think like emotional fitness like helps us avoid burnout? Even before actually exploring that area, I feel like, how do you define burnout? Because I feel like there's so much language, like everybody's like, oh, I'm burnt out, but I don't know the definition of it. I feel like varies for different people.
Yeah, there are a lot of definitions of it. I don't know if I have one perfect definition, but I can share how I think about it, which is, to me, burnout is a little like your car running out of gas and kind of sputtering to a halt, and it's not going to work anymore. And the reason I like that metaphor is that we know that we shouldn't wait until our car completely runs out of gas to think about how to put gas in the car. You know, it's so much more work if you completely run out of gas to deal with it. Now you're on the side of the road, you have to call AAA, you have to walk to the gas station, you might have damaged the engine, now you have to deal with that. It's a whole to do. Whereas if you had just put gas in the car before you ran out of gas, it would have not actually been that big of a deal. But for some reason, with our own energy levels, we will often wait until we are just in the midst of a complete burnout, exhaustion state of mind to think, oh, I should probably rest and take care of myself. And it's just so much less work to prevent burnout than it is to fix it. So I try to remind people, don't wait until you're exhausted to take care of yourself. And something I recommend people do is make a list of what your early warning signs are of burnout. What are the things that show that burnout is around the corner? So that might be that you lose your appetite, or you complain more, or your work stops feeling as fulfilling. Maybe you find yourself isolating more, or actually maybe you find that you don't want to be alone when you normally would enjoy your own company. Like, what are the early warning signs? And then ask people in your life to keep an eye out for those signs with you. You know, you might tell your partner or your colleagues or your friends, hey, if you notice me skipping meals or you notice me complaining about work a lot, remind me that we had this conversation. And then when those early warning signs pop up, put shock absorbers into place. Remind yourself to take a break and rest and refill your tank. And what that looks like for you is going to be unique. So for some people, that's going in nature, taking a mental health day, spending time with their pet, spending time alone, spending time with friends, whatever refills your tank. Do those things right when you see those early warning signs. Don't wait until you're completely exhausted.
Well, and I love that you pointed to like including community for accountability, because I think especially for therapists, like, again, I can just speak for myself. There's an independent streak to me of like, oh, I know this stuff, therefore I'm just going to implement it. But that usually fails at some point. So I love the, just thinking about the signals and also the accountability piece.
Yeah, we need each other. You know, therapists having other therapists is so important, because the average person just doesn't totally understand the experience and doesn't necessarily have the language to understand and speak back to the things that we've experienced. So that's so important. And then, you know, you're so right that often doctors are the least physically healthy people. Therapists are often not the ones taking care of their mental health the best. You know, we're good at explaining why it's important, but not always good at doing it ourselves. So recruiting support's really important.
Yeah. And I love that you pointed toward almost like preemptively doing stuff, right? Doing things as part of your routine. Because I think this is, I mean, just in the context of therapy, you know, when I was doing clinical work, I remember there would be like seasons where like I loved the work, right? And so then the tendency is to see more and more people instead of you know, because you're like, oh, I just enjoy this, or I just learned, went to this training, and therefore, you know, I want to be able to see some more folks so I can like work on those skills. But I think, in hindsight, I think one of the lessons or one of the things I wish I had like told young Armel was like, pace yourself. And, you know, because the journey is, you know, the journey's long, and it's not just like, I don't know, you think like, oh, you're just, you know, people will say you're just talking to people, but just the cumulative toll of that over you know.
It's so much more than that. You know, we know that.
Yeah.
But you're describing exactly why I wanted to find a more proactive approach to mental health. That there does feel like there's this attitude in our culture where you wait till things are really bad and then you go try to fix them. And we understand about our physical health that it's much easier to work out now than it is to wait till you have a disease and try to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And similarly with mental health, I believe a lot of our mental health struggles are a result of not being given the space and support and resources to do this fitness work along the way in life, you know, to feel the hard feelings, to sit with the difficult moments as they happen, and instead of letting them kind of accumulate into something really overwhelming. So therapists especially, we have to do that work so that we can have a sustainable practice of helping other people with theirs.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There was something you just said, but I'm sure it'll come back to me. What's your favorite practice in the book that listeners could try today?
Oh, like a push-up we could all do together right
now?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, or just like, that would be even awesomer.
Let's do that. So there's a push-up I talk about in the book that I try to do once a month myself. Mm. And any push-up that's in the book, I also practice because I wanted to make sure that it feels helpful and works and is doable. But one of the ones I love to suggest is, I think, a very underrated, important practice for any kind of business and any kind of relationship is feedback. asking for feedback. And as therapists, you know, I was kind of taught, you don't ask your patients for feedback. I'm not asking my patients, hey, how am I doing as a therapist? Am I doing well? What do you think? You know, because it's not really their job to support us in that way necessarily. And so I think sometimes that can end up extending to other places in life where we might not think that it's okay to ask for feedback. But it's really important that we see ourselves through the eyes of another person. We get that professionally through supervision and consultation, but perhaps less so in our personal relationships. So once a month, I send a text message to someone in my life, a different person each month. And the text message essentially says, hey, I'm working on my emotional fitness and your perspective is really important to me. I really respect and admire the way you see the world. And I'm curious if you would be willing to share one thing I'm doing well in our relationship and one thing I could do 10% better. And I send that text out every month. And I love the phrasing 10% better because it's a low lift. It doesn't ask someone to tell you everything that you should change about you, just one thing you could do a little better. My partner and I do this prompt often also. And I have found that it's really lovely to see what comes back. You know, you start to see patterns of things that you might work on. And it's also really important to see what's working and what you're doing well and how you're being seen and held and loved by the people in your life. So I would recommend everyone who wants to do a push-up right now, bust out your phone, type up that message in your own words, and send it out to someone in your life, and then see what comes back.
That's so cool. How do you brace for it? Like the 10%, like, oh, well, Emily,
so.
I was waiting for you to send that text because, yeah.
Yeah, it's not always easy. It's not always easy to see, but that's why mindfulness comes first. It's a little uncomfortable to do this, but it's a type of comfort that grows over time. Now I look forward to the responses because I've kind of been flexing this muscle for many months, and there are people in my life who've now gotten the message more than once for me, and it's an opportunity to sort of update. They tend to want the feedback back as well. So now you're building this culture in this relationship of being able to give each other feedback regularly, which I think is lovely. And then there have been times that what I've seen has been like, oh, that doesn't feel good to hear. But if you're saying it, then it's worth considering. It's worth at least thinking about whether I should change it. And in the book, I give the personal example of something that I heard back that felt hard to hear and how it helped me ultimately make that relationship stronger. So I'm curious, if you were to send this message out, what do you think it would feel like for you? What do you imagine you might get back?
Yeah. You're asking me?
Yeah, I'm asking you.
I think so. One, you know, the people pleaser in me like really struggles with this message. So I definitely have to like work on this, on this push up for sure. I think people would say, if there's like 10% better in a recent season, I've had to like cancel with some folks gatherings. And so, and I know there's at least been one or two cases where they've probably like rearranged their schedule. And so I think probably the feedback is, and I remember even like scheduling, thinking like, oh, I'm like stretched a little too thin. I should be able to do this, in fact, I had to do it this morning. And so I think the feedback would probably be like, hey, Mel, like if you're feeling exhausted, there's no, like, I'm still here. Like you don't have to, you know, feel obligated. So
that's a good one. And what about the positive feedback? Cause that's just as important.
Yeah. The positive one would be, I think people would say that, there's a kindness to my presence that feels really safe. And that,
oh, I feel that even talking to you right now.
Aw. I don't know. Like, I mean, I've shared this on the podcast, but like, I've really in many ways struggled with my own voice because I don't sort of fit the typical sort of masculine, you know, especially in a more Western society. And I used to think of that as more of like a flaw. And I would try to then emulate like what I was supposed to be like, but then I struggled with that piece too. So, I think that's what people would probably say. So.
Oh, well, I feel that and agree with that. And isn't that a lesson we're all learning, that authenticity ends up being a lot less work somehow, yeah. but being yeah. able to get there is a lot of work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Emily, I'm so thankful for you. I cannot believe the time flew by like this, but you're doing some pretty amazing stuff in the world. Where can we connect with you? Where can we learn about the book? Where can we learn about the awesome work you're doing in the world?
Yeah. So I'm on all the social platforms. My handle is at Dr. Emily Anhalt, and you can find me at dremilyanhalt.com. And the book is on, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, all of those places. And yeah, I'd love to hear about people's emotional fitness journeys and connect with anyone. It's really a pleasure to be out there seeing my fellow clinicians taking this up. So thank you so much for everything you do to support the community and for having me.
No, you're so welcome. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Hey there, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Emily, and especially if you've been navigating a season where you're thinking about how to take care of your emotional fitness. I hope today's podcast conversation has been incredibly helpful for you. Definitely encourage you to check out Emily's book. We'll include that in the show notes as well, which is, and the book is Flex Your Feelings. I was thinking a lot about this conversation. The line that really resonated for me is, therapy is teaching people to play. That was such a great line that Emily said. And I think a lot about that in the businesses that we're building, how we know this intellectually, but the practical application is not always there for us as clinicians, right? And how wonderful it would be if we saw therapy as just beyond just modalities and things like that. Of course, those are important, but seeing it as an opportunity, the clients that are coming into our room, they're struggling, and how do we sort of foster and create and inspire them and create space for creativity and all of those kind of things. Emily's doing some pretty awesome stuff. You can definitely connect with her on all of the major social media platforms. I'm active on LinkedIn, and she is there as well. So we'd love to connect with, encourage you to connect with Emily there, and definitely would love to connect with you there as well. Also, be sure to check out Emily's book. Again, it's called Flex Your Feelings. Have a great rest of your day, and I will see you next time. Bye. Hey there, thank you so much for tuning in to today's session. Just wanted to also let you know that we have a free email newsletter that goes out every week. You can download it over at sellingthecouch.com/newsletter. Basically, that newsletter contains some of the stuff that's happening behind the scenes with STC and also with my life and how I'm balancing and trying to balance being both an entrepreneur as well as building a life around my family and my health as well. And it also contains the latest podcast episode and some of the stuff that I'm doing on LinkedIn, some of the strategies and things that are working for me. And then finally, a brand new section called On Mel's Mind, where I take a video or a book or a blog post or something like that that's inspiring me for that week, and I share how I'm implementing it both in my life and in my business. Again, you can download that over at sellingthecouch.com/newsletter. And if you are one of the 3,700 colleagues that have been a part of the email newsletter, I so appreciate you, and I'm grateful for your support. We genuinely try to make these helpful, and just based on the data and based on the feedback we're getting, it seems like we're doing a really good job. So appreciate you, and I hope that you have a great day.